stand up and demand respect for human life and for human rights. And these kinds of protests in the halls of Congress, before the State Department, in front of the White House, in Grand Central Station, in the streets, everywhere, particularly with this climate that is trying to suppress critique of these current policies, it's only going to come from civil society.
Greg McIver, these will be shaken loose. We thank you so much, international human rights lawyer.
From applicant tracking systems to chatbots to facial recognition, artificial intelligence is transforming our world for the better and also for the worse. Tune in Thursdays at 9 a.m. starting November 2nd for The Imaginary Possible, a show that looks at the captivating potentials and the troubling realities of artificial intelligence today. Only on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and Fat Cupcake, with locations in Oregon City, Happy Valley, and a new location in Southeast Portland. Information at fatcupcake.com.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Time now for the 5 o'clock news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland teachers are officially on strike for smaller class sizes, mental health supports, and more planning time.
The WNBA pauses talks on bringing a team to Portland.
And in international news, some injured people in Gaza have been allowed to cross into Egypt.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Chris Gao. Over 4,000 Portland public school teachers are on strike for the first time today, leaving over 45,000 students out of school. The Portland Association of Teachers is asking for higher wages, more lesson planning time, a cap on class sizes, and mental health supports for students. Their contract expired in June, and they've been in negotiations for nearly a year. Angela Bonilla, the union president, said, quote, "We are on strike not just for ourselves, but for our students," end quote. Portland Public Schools has offered around half the raises the union is asking for, and says it doesn't have the funds to meet all of the union's demands. Officials say funding from the state legislature has not kept up with inflation, and a state law limits the district's ability to raise taxes.
Governor Kotek, who was endorsed by a statewide teachers union, said any increase in state funding will have to wait for the 2025 budget. Kotek made critical comments of the strike yesterday, saying, quote, "My message right now to Portland Public Schools and the Portland Association of Teachers, you need to stay at the table and you need to figure this out. Going on strike is not in the best interest of students or families," end quote. KBOO's Althea Billings interviewed Rachel Haynes, a fifth grade teacher and member of the Portland Association of Teachers. Here's what she had to say in response to Governor Kotek.
I would hope she would realize and understand that we have hit a point where this is so unsustainable, that teachers, educators feel so demoralized and disheartened by their lack of support and lack of resources, that we need to do our job to serve our students. The fact that 99% of our membership voted, or is a 99% strike vote, should say something about the level of, we feel like we can't wait any longer. The need is so dire that we feel like if the district cannot meet us to talk about these real issues and really negotiate on some of these key issues, then we have to show how much we need this for our students, how much we need things to change. They cannot stay the same because this is not working. You know, I've heard people say, like, this is going to disrupt learning and make a disruption for families and students, which I totally agree it is. But I think that people don't realize how disrupted learning is every day when the people in the building are trying so desperately to meet needs that they can't because they are under-resourced. You know, this is not something that we take lightly. And our bargaining team has been, they're teachers, they're educators. So they're taking time, they're still teaching, you know, and they're taking time out to do this important work. And they have been dedicated to this process and given countless hours and so much time and effort towards this. And when proposals are met with nothing, no response, where do we go? Where do we go from there to show how important this really is, that we get this help that we need?
That was Rachel Haynes, a fifth grade teacher and member of the Portland Association of Teachers. A survey of Oregonians found significant support for teachers going on strike for smaller class sizes, mental health support, and higher wages. The strike is scheduled for today and tomorrow, but could be extended, and students already had Friday off for a teacher's professional development day.
WNBA is pausing its plans to bring an expansion team to Portland. WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert explained in a letter to Senator Ron Wyden this week that upcoming renovations to the Moda Center were a sticking point. The lack of a dedicated team practice facility was also an issue. Engelbert said the pause will last until, quote, the timing and the scope of the improvements to Moda Arena are settled, end quote. The Moda Center is scheduled to have renovation work done over the course of multiple summers, which would directly conflict with the WNBA regular season. The WNBA has been in talks for a year with local entrepreneur Kirk Brown about the expansion. Brown would be the main investor in a potential team ownership group. Early last month, the WNBA announced it will bring an expansion franchise to San Francisco starting in 2025. It isn't known when or if talks between Portland and the WNBA will resume.
Sushila Jayapal announces she'll be running for U.S. Congress. The Multnomah County Commissioner will be one of an expected crowded field vying for Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. This after acting Democratic U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer announced on Monday to Willamette Week he will retire at the end of next year. Blumenauer will conclude a run in Congress that began in 1996. He's advocated for infrastructure, green energy, and alternative transportation projects. While Blumenauer spoke out against the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, he has stopped short of calling for a ceasefire against the continued Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. Jayapal announced her campaign and initial endorsements this morning. She says she plans to be a, quote, strong progressive voice in Congress. Among her campaign promises are championing abortion rights, fighting climate change and polluters, and defending democracy from election deniers. Because Multnomah County bars commissioners from running for other offices during their term, Jayapal is expected to resign from her commissionership. Her sister, Pramila Jayapal, is a current Democratic U.S. representative for the majority of the Seattle area. Oregon's 3rd Congressional District covers most of Portland, east of the Willamette, as well as northeast Clackamas County and all of Hood River County.
The Food and Drug Administration is warning people not to consume certain Wanabana brand fruit puree pouches because they contain high levels of lead. Wanabana apple cinnamon flavor fruit pouches contain, quote, extremely high concentrations of lead. The FDA advised that if kids have consumed apple cinnamon puree pouches, they should get a blood test. Parents who are worried their child might have been exposed should talk to a healthcare provider. Signs and symptoms of lead poisoning can vary. Short-term exposure can lead to headaches, abdominal pain, vomiting, and anemia. Longer-term exposure can lead to irritability, tiredness, muscle ache, constipation, tremors, and weight loss. The pouches are sold at various stores, including at Dollar Tree and online at Amazon. Wanabana has issued a voluntary recall of the apple cinnamon pouches and said in a press release that it is working closely with the FDA to find the source of the contamination. Lead exposure is bad for all ages, but is particularly harmful to kids.
5 days into his term as Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson has struck his first blow. Johnson has stripped aid to Ukraine and Taiwan from President Biden's $105 billion aid package. The $14.3 billion in aid to Israel remains, but Biden must agree to cut the same amount of the money the Internal Revenue Service uses to chase down high-income tax cheats. A study published earlier this year by the National Bureau of Economic Research found that every additional dollar spent on auditing high-income taxpayers yielded $12 in new revenue for the Treasury.
President Biden issues an anticipated executive order on AI. Senate leaders say they are displeased with the House GOP standalone aid package for Israel, and a Georgia bill would let teachers carry guns in the classroom. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 TED Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In some cases, AI is making life worse. For example, using teenagers' personal data to figure out what will keep them glued to their device, AI makes social media more addictive. It's causing what our Surgeon General calls a profound risk of harm to their mental health and well-being.
After long discussions, President Joe Biden is issuing an executive order giving guidance on artificial intelligence. Critics charge facial recognition can falsely identify people of color as criminals and say AI can speed the spread of disinformation. Numerous states are also suing Facebook parent Meta for using AI to make social media addictive for young people, but some in Congress hope any legislation will be more balanced. Republican Senator Todd Young of Indiana cites its commercial possibilities.
We need to be able to capture this upside potential, ensure the United States of America continues to stay in the driver's seat when it comes to the development and deployment of AI technologies, but manage some of these risks.
Meanwhile, House leadership is unveiling an aid package for Israel. The bill, now headed to the Appropriations Committee, offsets the funding through $14.3 billion in cuts for the IRS. It's unclear if the measure can pass the House, let alone the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the GOP is using aid for Israel to slash tax enforcement that many say more than pays for itself.
The House GOP package is woefully inadequate, has the hard right's fingerprints all over it, making aid to Israel, who just faced the worst terrorist attack in history, contingent on poison pills that help ultra-wealthy tax cheats.
The House proposal also includes no aid for Ukraine. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says that military assistance should be included because the wars are connected. He pointed to anti-Semitic attacks in Russia.
After weeks of pro-Hamas propaganda spewed from the Kremlin, an angry mob overran a provincial airport and surrounded a plane that had just arrived from Israel. Chillingly, the mob went person to person, checking passports and asking if they were Muslim or Jew.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has called for a ceasefire in Gaza, but has not condemned the October 7th attacks by Hamas. Russia has been buying arms from Iran for the war in Ukraine. Iran denies it's supporting Hamas, although it has in the past. Here at home, education advocates are skeptical about a Georgia bill to let teachers carry guns in schools. It would provide firearms training and a $10,000 stipend to teachers who go armed. Lisa Morgan with the Georgia Association of Educators says it would only make schools more dangerous.
We do not enhance the safety of our children by introducing more weapons into the school setting. I think about what happens if the teacher is attacked and their weapon is taken away from them, and then other educators, other students are then harmed.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his latest article, tackling misconceptions on who is responsible for waste dumped on public property. At 6 p.m., it's Eco Justice Radio. Then at 7, The Global Sale with T.K. Kapura. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 46. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 63. Today in history, in 1848, American physician, educator, and activist Caroline Still Anderson was born. She was a pioneering doctor in Philadelphia and one of the first black women to become a doctor in the United States. The quote of the day is from American poet Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote, quote, "The progress of the intellect is to the clear vision of causes, which neglects surface differences. To the poet, to the philosopher, to the saint, all things are friendly and sacred, all events profitable, all days holy, all men divine," end quote.
At least 320 foreign passport holders have crossed to Egypt from Gaza through the Rafah border crossing today. Another 76 injured people have been transferred into Egypt. The crossing opened yesterday for the first time in more than 3 weeks of the brutal conflict, including many days where the area of the border crossing was bombed by Israel. Evacuation of people with dual citizenship, foreign passports, and those with severe injuries is expected to continue. A top United Nations official has resigned his post in protest of the war in Gaza. In his resignation letter, Craig McIver writes that the UN is failing its duty to prevent a genocide of Palestinian civilians in Gaza under Israeli bombardment. McIver was the director of the New York office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
The Grand Gateway Hotel in South Dakota is facing yet another discrimination lawsuit for the business's policies against Native patrons. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Grand Gateway Hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, already embroiled in legal battles, now faces yet another discrimination lawsuit. It's the latest development since the business and its policies revolted into national attention last summer. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's CJ Keene reports.
The hotel has been entrenched in legal battles since ownership last year posted to social media their intentions to, quote, ban any native from property, leading to months of protests and multiple lawsuits. Those properties include the Grand Gateway Hotel and Cheers Lounge in Rapid City. The latest suit, from a Wisconsin family, alleges they were denied service at the hotel based on the race of a Native family member. Court documents say Jessica White, who is Caucasian, was not bothered as she attempted to check into the hotel on vacation this August. Her husband Ryan, who is Native, unloaded their car and entered the lobby second. The lawsuit alleges the employee abruptly denied the couple service or honored the booking after Ryan entered. After contacting Travelocity, the family confirmed 3 rooms reserved at the hotel. Despite the Travelocity representative confirming the booking and speaking to hotel staff, the employee still refused the family the rooms. At this point, the employee of the hotel reportedly told the Travelocity representative, who spoke with an accent, to, quote, speak English, which the lawsuit alleges reinforced the racial nature of the incident. Further, the family says the employee told Ryan to leave the lobby, called for security, and told security to bring backup before then telling Jessica he would call dispatch. Feeling threatened for the safety of himself and his children, Ryan White then left the hotel. The lawsuit alleges the White family was not refused service on plausible basis and instead were the victims of unlawful discrimination, which fits into a larger pattern for the business. The suit asks for the courts to declare the hotel's conduct unlawful and for the family to be reimbursed for their attorney fees and awarded damages at trial. Owner Connie Urey has already been convicted of 2 counts of simple assault for an incident in May, which saw her spray cleaner at protesters. Representatives from the hotel did not return request for comment. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
Milwaukee County signed a Rights of Nature resolution last week, becoming the first in Wisconsin to endorse the indigenous legal movement. Lena Tran of Station WUWM has more.
The resolution was signed steps from the Menominee River, which plays a central role in the Menominee Indian tribe of Wisconsin's creation story. Now, the county recognizes the water's right to thrive. Here's Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley.
And it's exactly why we're here today, to state clearly and unequivocally that Milwaukee County land and waterways deserves to be protected and maintained to be healthy, robust, and resilient.
Guy Ryder is a Menominee citizen and leads the movement in the state. He likened the moment to the moon landing.
This is one step for man and then a huge step for our environment, and that's the kind of the way I think about it, because it's been a very long time that we've been able to think of our environment as a part of us, as not something that's external, but it is internal.
The resolution doesn't have the teeth of legal penalties, but organizers hope it inspires communities across the state to take similar steps. Megan Keller is a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. She said the resolution is an important tool.
So I feel like having this legal framework to stand on will help further that cause, but also really prevent people from being like traumatized and punished for standing up for our mother.
She said Indigenous women especially have been criminalized for protecting water in the Great Lakes. Rights of Nature gives them legs to stand on. For National Native News, I'm Lena Tran in Milwaukee.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Historical and predominantly black community colleges are often overlooked for funding, and advocates are discussing ways to improve that. Lumina Foundation and Complete Colleges of America held a webinar to look at the need and how these institutions provide for students. Shantia Hudson has more in Alabama.
Historical and predominantly black community colleges often get overlooked when it comes to funding for higher education. However, leaders across the country are seeking ways to ensure adequate support for these institutions. Complete College America and Lumina Foundation organized a webinar to discuss the needs of these colleges and their crucial role in promoting equal opportunities for black students. Chandra Scott from Alabama Possible was a part of the discussion and emphasized the need for funding and providing wraparound services to under-resourced students. One solution she proposed is engaging local industries that benefit from these students.
So we have to make sure that they understand their role in the process as well. Especially in Alabama, when you look at the economic impact of our community colleges, I mean, you're talking about over $6 billion of impact that they have in the economy in our state. So we have to make sure that the business industry is returning that investment.
She highlights that more than a quarter of the black population in the state struggle with poverty, posing a challenge in achieving Governor Kay Ivey's target of attaining 500,000 skilled workers by 2025. In Alabama's case, Scott points out that funding plays a crucial role in supporting the stranded workforce, individuals striving for a degree but held back by financial obstacles. She suggests tackling this issue by eliminating practices like transcript withholding, which disproportionately hinders minorities from returning to school.
We're still blocking them with different policies and really targeting certain populations, and so we have to figure out how do we best support them.
Advocates from other states also highlighted the essential resources that HBCCs and PBCCs offer to support first-generation students and emphasize the need for impactful research that reflects their community influence. Many also state that there needs to be additional overall funding to support programs and support services. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
A bill in New York would make the location of lead pipes in the state known to its residents. While investments have been made in removing lead pipes, environmentalists feel more could be done to ensure all New Yorkers have access to clean drinking water. Edwin J. Vieira reports.
New York environmentalists want Governor Kathy Hochul to sign a bill making it easier to know where lead pipes are located. The Lead Pipe Right to Know Act would require information about the location of lead pipes be made accessible online for New Yorkers to easily access. The Natural Resources Defense Council finds there are more than 360,000 lead pipes across the state. Robert Hayes with Environmental Advocates New York describes what else alongside this bill will get rid of lead pipes.
At the end of the day, it's going to take money to dig up lead pipes. And we've seen really historic investments made at the federal level to replace lead pipes through President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law. And now we need the state government to step up with a similar type of commitment.
He notes advocates are also calling on Hochul to include an extra $100 million for lead service line replacement in the upcoming budget. Since 2017, $5 billion has been dedicated to clean water work, although less than 1% has gone to fixing lead pipes. Estimates find it will cost at least $2.5 billion to replace all lead pipes in the state. Along with state and federal investments, municipalities can take initiative on removing lead pipes, too. Earlier this year, the city of Troy established its Get the Lead Out plan to remove the city's estimated 14,000 lead pipes. Hayes notes this plan can serve as a framework for other towns and cities looking to get the ball rolling on lead pipe removal.
Since May of this year, Troy's replaced about 80 lead pipes and intends to continue that. That's what local governments seem to be doing all across the state. These pipes are in almost every city in New York, from Buffalo to Albany to New York City, and we can't wait any longer to get the lead out of drinking water.
A New York City Coalition to End Lead Poisoning report finds 41% of water service lines are made of lead or possibly made of lead pipes. This means 21% of the city's residents live in a household with lead or possibly lead service lines. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
A Colorado school is looking at installing solar canopies over its parking lot. The project is estimated to lower school energy bills, provide educational opportunities for students, and help struggling families. Eric Galatas has more.
Colorado schools are joining the struggle to hold off the worst impacts of climate change and lower their energy bills by installing solar canopies on top of overheating parking lots. Over $33 million from a climate fund approved by Denver voters will be invested to install and maintain canopies at 12 schools and other locations. Emily Gedeon with the city's climate office says schools and communities across Denver will see significant benefits.
The energy produced by these solar panels are going to power the school. The excess energy that's generated is going to be donated by bill credits to DPS families in need.
The canopies are projected to save hundreds of low-income families up to $700 a year on their utility bills. City officials expect to get most of the initial investment back through Inflation Reduction Act tax credits and credits from Xcel Energy. Work on a 309-kilowatt canopy is underway at Denver Public Schools Northeast Early College High School, where students from traditionally underserved communities can earn college credits and professional certificates. Gedeon says the solar project is a good fit for the school's Environmental Pathways program, where students explore green energy careers.
There's a great hands-on opportunity for students to be able to learn about clean energy, how it works, when there are peak hours of the day, when they're generating the most electricity, and learning about how our grid works and how clean energy integrates into it.
She says the canopies will also reduce the urban heat island effect created by sun-blasted parking lots. Once online, the solar arrays are expected to produce nearly 10 million kilowatt hours of electricity a year and eliminate 70,000 metric tons of climate pollution over the next decade.
The power produced by these solar canopies is equivalent to planting over 1 million trees. We're getting 1,500 cars off the road every year.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Inmates in Oregon and across the West are nurturing sagebrush seedlings that are then transplanted into areas torched by wildfires. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At correctional facilities in Idaho, Oregon, and other Western states, inmates are growing sagebrush.
From sowing the seeds in May to boxing up the seedlings in October, they're in charge of fertilizing, watering, thinning, and checking out for diseased plants.
Allison Singer is with the Sagebrush in Prisons Project in Idaho and Eastern Oregon. Scrubby sagebrush landscapes provide critical habitat for hundreds of plants and animal species. But many of these areas are threatened by the growing risk of wildfire. And after a fire, invasive grasses can take over, providing more fuel for future blazes. So the seedlings the inmates are growing will be transplanted into areas that have burned. Patrick Kirk took part in the program while an inmate at Snake River Correctional Institution in Eastern Oregon. He says working in the greenhouse taught him new skills that are invaluable after prison.
How to make your own decisions and learn to overcome problems. Now I'm out and in the community, you have to problem solve every day, so I think it really helped. So not only does it help the environment, but it helps the people.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we turn to our KBOO news poet, Dan Raphael, who already wants a new Speaker of the House.
Yeah, it's been a week, but the choice of Mike Johnson as chairman of the House still has me so depressed it's hard to look up and more painful to look ahead. Government shutdown in a couple weeks, Social Security and Medicare eviscerated, and why bother holding a presidential election because Trump will win no matter the votes. It's all in the Bible, Johnson said, like Israel can have more weapons if we have fewer IRS agents auditing campaign donors. Today is All Saints Day, and we need all the saints we can get. Most saints weren't saintly prisses, but adamantly principled, killed for not surrendering. I hope we in the planet don't need martyrs. There's plenty dying for the wrong reasons in Palestine, Israel, Sudan, Maine. But how many of us are stepping up, stepping out, not to confront, but to find a common ground with our fellow regular folk, all of us depleted and denied by the rich and powerful who could do so much for the world? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Your You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is the great Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Galatis, Shantia Hudson, and our own benevolent climate czar, Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Chris Gao. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his latest article. It's called Living in a Glass House. Despite public perception, Metro data shows housed residents are responsible for most waste dumped on public property. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. So your new piece covers this common narrative of trash and homeless camps, but compares that to the data that Metro has. So what did you find?
Yeah, I found that despite the public's perception and a lot of conversations from, you know, anyone from the governor's office to the city, county, talking about the city needing to clean up trash, Metro RID data actually shows that unhoused people are responsible for just 26% of trash that they